This is Main Street on Prairie Public, a place where we gather to listen, to learn, and to discuss. Doug Hamilton is on vacation. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up just a bit later in the show, we're going to visit the Red River Valley Research Corridor's Bioindustry Summit. This year, the focus is on how to feed, fuel, heal, and build the world. But we're going to start today talking about a member of the cannabis sativa species known as hemp. Why is it controversial? Why is it beneficial? And could it be headed this way? Joining me now is Rachel Seifert-Spilde. She is a plant protection specialist with the North Dakota Department of Agriculture. Rachel, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, of course.
Let's start with, what does a plant protection specialist do?
We have several plant protection specialists within the department, and we each, although we work together, we each have our own specialties, hemp being one of mine. I also conduct nursery and grower inspections, as well as facilitate export certification and work on egg pest surveys.
Is this all going on at a completely commercial level, or when you say nursery inspections, does this mean anything that I might buy at a nursery?
Yeah, it is anything you might buy. Anybody with a nursery license. So I'm conducting nursery inspections now, and then later in July, growing inspections.
So what kinds of things do you check for when you do your inspections?
Non-hardy species, pests and diseases, anything that is not really viable, so anything that a homeowner might purchase that is not in very good condition or not likely to survive.
Well, we're mostly here today to focus on hemp. Can we give like sort of a background for hemp's history in the United States?
Yeah, hemp has been around for a long time. Some information I found from the North American Industrial Hemp Association sort of focuses on some more interesting sort of background on hemp, saying that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson both grew hemp. Ben Franklin owned a mill that made hemp paper. Thomas Jefferson drafted the Declaration of Independence on hemp paper, those types of things.
So it's been around a long time.
It has.
And yet it's not really in any mass production in any sense of the word when it comes to growth within the United States, and particularly not around here. What are some of the barriers that this plant is facing right now?
If you go way back in the U.S. history of hemp, in 1938 there was a Marijuana Tax Act, and that essentially ended, you know, mass hemp production. But during World War II, the government actually urged farmers to grow it for the much-needed rope and textile manufacturing. In 1970, Congress designated industrial hemp, along with marijuana and heroin, as a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substances Act, making it illegal to grow and without a license from the DEA. But it's my understanding that Hawaii has the distinction of being the first and only state ever to receive a DEA permit for the production of hemp. They had a small quarter research plot that was surrounded with a 12-foot chain link fence topped with razor wire and security monitoring, infrared surveillance. That, I believe, was permitted in 1999, and that has since expired. So really, the Drug Enforcement Agency hasn't really permitted many people or institutions.
12-foot high fences for a research plot on hemp. We better maybe compare it to the more notorious relatives of the plant, like you said, like marijuana. How is it similar and different from that?
Although it's in the same family, it's very different. Industrial hemp has or should have less than 0.3% of the active psychotropic compound, the tetrahydrocannabinol, the THC, whereas marijuana can be anywhere from, you know, that 3 or 5% up to as much as 20%. So if someone was to try and smoke marijuana or smoke industrial hemp, they wouldn't get any kind of a mild, you know, buzz, as some people might call it. They would have to smoke an incredible amount, and the vapors and other things in industrial hemp, that would be almost impossible for our body to withstand.
So what is industrial hemp used for then?
There are two different main types of hemp. One is used for fiber, and the other is used for oil. So, you know, the fiber can be used for textiles, rope, paper, building materials. But the hemp seed is actually used for food, fuel, feed, and oil. The oil is really low in saturated fats. It's also the basis for pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, ink, lubrications, household detergents, stain removers. Like, it really has a wide variety of uses.
For the stuff that is available on the market, where is most of that being grown right now then, if not very much in the U.S.?
I know Canada has a pretty large program, the Ukraine, the actual commodity that we have to bring into the United States can come from a variety, I guess, of different industrialized countries.
What kind of efforts are underway to maybe pave the way for industrial hemp to be allowed here?
The most recent farm bill that was passed, I believe, in February of 2014, included a section regarding the legitimacy of industrial hemp. And that essentially, it gives two options. It gives ag departments the authority to host pilot projects or academic research. In North Dakota, we are actually focusing on the academic research portion of that legitimacy of industrial hemp section.
Okay, what does that mean? What are you doing?
Well, in North Dakota and in, I think, 9 or 10 other states, we already have industrial hemp legislation. So we already have the process to essentially license people, academic institutions, et cetera. So with that legislation that we already have in place and with the authority of the new Farm Bill would give us, we are working with NDSU to try and get a small research plot in place.
Is this a profitable crop?
Absolutely. Even on small acreages, the return you would get on industrial hemp fiber seed would be pretty profitable.
Like, how would it compare to maybe tomatoes or potatoes or something that you might know off the top of your head?
I would think it would be extremely profitable, much more so than those other commodities.
You said small acreage farmers. I have friends who have a farm north of town. Could they apply and grow industrial hemp?
At this point, they could apply for a North Dakota hemp license. However, because private individuals weren't really identified in the farm bill, they would still have to go through the same procedure that's been in place for quite a few years. They would have to apply with the Drug Enforcement Agency. So most likely not. I could license them in North Dakota, but the likelihood of them getting a DEA registration is not very promising right now.
What about this research plot that you mentioned? What kinds of hoops and red tape was there to get that set up?
It's kind of been a gray area up until recently. You know, we can sort of take the Farm Bill language and interpret it. But at this point, we haven't been able to find any industrial hemp seed really to use in the U.S. So the real process that is time-consuming and sort of resource-demanding has been trying to get hemp seed imported from Canada. And I recently heard from the Drug Enforcement Agency headquarters that they are still going to require NDSU to get a hemp permit. And so that is difficult and time-consuming, but necessary, apparently.
What do you hope to learn in a research plot? What could you learn?
There are several things that, you know, we could learn. And the Farm Bill allows for several things. But different cultivars that would grow well, marketing techniques, crop rotations, those types of things would be extremely interesting.
How is it harvested?
I believe traditionally, but I think it probably depends on whether you're growing it for fiber or whether you're growing it for seed.
With all of the red tape surrounding this, is it worth it? Why is this worth considering growing?
Industrial hemp requires few pesticides or herbicides. It's relatively disease-free and prevents weed infestations. It's a good rotation crop because it may enhance the yields in the crops that follow it.
In the DEA process, is it all just background information, criminal checks and everything, or are they actually going to come out from time to time to look at any kind of plot that might be established?
I believe they would. Some of the DEA points that I've heard of concerns are that industrial hemp would provide an easy cover sort of to plant marijuana in between. But it's actually a bad idea. If someone was a farmer and seriously considering this, if marijuana was planted with industrial hemp, it could easily cross-pollinate and it would result in a dramatically inferior product for either of the hemp uses.
Can't fool the plants.
Right. The DEA is concerned about, you know, people hiding marijuana within their hemp planting. They feel that law enforcement couldn't raid a grow site without a warrant, which would be hard to get without a sample to test for the THC level. They also say that they feel it's indistinguishable from marijuana without a scientific analysis. And they say there is an easy and inexpensive way to convert the low-grade marijuana into high-grade hashish oil, which I'm not very familiar with. I'm not sure. But that is a concern that they have listed.
Indistinguishable, is it? Don't they look, I mean, same species, but don't they look a little bit different?
The fiber variety does look quite a bit different. It's tall. It has fewer leaves, fewer seeds. When it's grown for seed, though, it does resemble marijuana. It's shorter, bushier, planted a little bit or spaced a little bit further apart to allow for more leaves and seeds, where the hemp grown for fiber is grown closer together and has a lot more stalk, fewer seeds, fewer leaves. It's less bushy.
Rachel Seifert-Spilde is a plant protection specialist with the North Dakota Department of Agriculture. Rachel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
We'll be back with Ron Smith after this break.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them. Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with the gathering swarms on nature, an examination of creatures that come together. Then at 8 Central on Nova, bombing Hitler's dams. Join us tonight on Prairie Public.
We're back on Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on vacation, and it is the growing season. It's a time when we are joined more or less once a week by Ron Smith. He is our resident horticulturist and, well, you know, growing things expert. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
It's beautiful today. Yes, the spring has finally made its showing. The leaves are out. The grass is growing. And the insects are starting to show up. The birds are all back and looking for food to eat. So we gardeners should be in our happy mode. And my wife and I have planted our tomatoes. We're going to plant our peppers in the next couple of days. And we're knocking on wood that no more frosts are going to show up. So if you want to be optimistic, follow what the Smiths have done. If you're a little bit pessimistic or realistic, and wait until after the big weekend, and then get, you know, wait till the last week in May, early June, to go ahead and do your planning. But keep in mind, we have very, very short growing seasons here. So we could have a very early fall with a September frost, and that ends everything. So, you know, watch your timing.
Don't
on things.
That.
It's bad both ends of the season, the beginning and at the end of the season.
Well, especially right now, there's just like a general sort of mess everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on?
Well, we haven't really had good growing weather. We've had weather that's barely hitting 50 degrees for the most part. And that's just really the threshold for growth. And beyond that, when we get into the 60s and the 70s, like we are anticipating are going to be coming our way for the balance of the month and into early June, things will really take off and grow. So once the temperature stays consistently warm, doesn't dip down close to freezing at night, we're going to see things take off and grow. Then we'll be complaining the next time we talk about, my grass is growing too fast, what can I do to slow it down? That type of thing. So
I think a lot of people take advantage of the first nice day of spring and go out and do a lot of planting. And in the back of their minds, there's always sort of that, you're supposed to wait till Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a concern that for, let's just say, for example, like a perennial, sort of a tree or a hedge or something like that, do you have to worry about stunting the growth too much if it was, you know, in the lower 30s?
But your mature, established plants, even your herbaceous perennials that we're noticing, that my wife declared dead, sweet woodruff, they're coming back from the root system, the crown. And so I would say, no, you don't have anything to worry about. Let things go ahead and go through the process of coming back to life slowly. You'll be surprised at where you're going to see the new growth showing up. And where new growth doesn't show and it stays dead, cut it out. Prune it out. That's what you have pruning shears for.
There's always more plants, right?
Absolutely.
We have an email question from Brian in Bismarck, who says, can we grow balsam fir in zone 3? I've planted 12 to 16-inch trees, two springs in a row, and they look good until about midwinter. And during the winters, the needles turn rust color, and new growth emerges at the bud's end.
Balsam fir. Okay. Mm-hmm. No, it will not grow here in North Dakota. It's a beautiful tree in the Carolinas and Virginia and Pennsylvania even, and even in the southern part of New York State, but we're just too cold here. It's a beautiful tree. I wish we could grow it. If we could, I think everybody would want one in their yard.
What does it look like?
Well, they're soft. First of all, their needles are soft, which puts them light years ahead of the Colorado blue spruce, which everyone plants. They maintain a nice symmetrical shape. They're America's favorite short-needled Christmas tree. They have a nice balsam fir scent to them. They have a double needle arrangement on their stems, so they have a nice full appearance to them. And they're easy to grow. And where they do grow, they're absolutely beautiful. If you were living in the Carolinas, you'd want to have a plantation of balsam fir.
All right.
For nothing else than just to look at and walk through and smell.
Brian, you either need to find a new tree or you need to relocate.
Yep.
Another email question from Derek in West Fargo, who had sod installed last July.
Mm-hmm.
Now that spring has come, should he aerate, power rake, or do nothing? The sod is firmly rooted, and he left it at about 3.5 inches at the end of last year. Mm-hmm. It's been bagging the grass when mowing, but there's plenty of thatch.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're at the stage right now where we can go ahead and power rake, core aerate everything else now, because the grass is actively growing, and it'll recover very quickly from that. That's a kind of a traumatic treatment for the lawn, but it's one of those traumatic treatments. It's like getting out and running a mile, you know, in the morning, because it's the best thing to do, gets you in good shape. It's a traumatic treatment of your body, but it's the same thing. If you're alive and kicking and you want to get better, you're going to do that kind of a thing. And so to improve your lawn, your old lawn, especially if it's got a lot of thatch, core aeration followed up by power raking, followed up by a light fertilization and overseeding if needed, is the best thing to go ahead and do. And we're right in the prime now. Between now and, I would say, the middle of June is the prime time to go ahead and do that.
Do you need to wait for any kind of a forecast, looking for a few clear days, or does it not matter if it rains while the lawn is kind of torn up?
Well, the best thing to do, in fact, just the night before last night, actually, our neighbor had his lawn core aerated, and the next day, why, he had a nice rain. And so it turned out to be a very, very good thing for him. The timing was perfect. I don't know whether he's a gambler or not, but it turned out perfectly for him to have a dry period over the weekend and then have it have the core aerated and then have it followed up by a rain. You couldn't ask for anything better. So,
if it's not going to be out raining, do you need to be very vigilant about watering it?
Well, in the early spring, generally we have enough incidental rainfall that that's going to take care of itself. If we're into, let's just say we get into mid-June to late June, and we're starting to see a reduction in the incidental rainfall, we're looking ahead to no rain for a week or 10 days in the forecast, and we're talking about temperatures hovering in the middle 80s or 80s, that's something you have to sit down and think, do I really want to do it now? I have to follow up with a good irrigation or good irrigation practices after that. And you also have to have good irrigation practices before that, because you don't want to be trying to core aerate a soil that's as hard as a blacktop parking lot. So you need to have either irrigated 2 or 3 days before you have it core aerated and then follow up with a good irrigation after you've had it core aerated, because it's going to have a tendency to dry the soil out. And if we're into a hot temperature regime, that's going to dry it out too fast and you're going to get injury to your lawn.
So you really want to get this done in
In the spring when we're having these incidental rainfalls that can pop up and give you a nice shower.
All right. We have another email question from Celeste. How can you get rid of horsetail? It's a nasty weed.
It is. Yes, it's an absolutely terrible weed. And if you don't know what horsetails are, don't worry about it. Consider yourself blessed. horsetails are a weed that really grows like a horse's tail. And they love wet, acid soil that's very, very poorly drained. And the best thing you can do to get rid of them is to be patient, try to do something, anything, everything to improve the drainage, even if you have to go ahead and install tiles, drain tiles, to get that water off of your property or off of your site. That'll pull the water away. Then go ahead and lime it and give it several applications of lime to work it into that soil. And then check the pH of the soil to see if it's somewhere near 7 and neutral or even slightly alkaline. It won't hurt anything. And then check for the nutrient status, N, P, and K. And then adjust the fertilization, add some fertilizer to go ahead and get it up to a normal status as far as that goes. And that'll keep the horsetail out. It loves, it thrives in under anaerobic soil conditions, and so with water. So you'll find it growing in swampy, boggy areas. And so, you know, if you don't know what it is, don't worry about it. If you have it, that's the only way that I know of to go ahead and control it, because herbicides just don't do a permanent job.
Sounds like Creeping Charlie a little bit. Like
Yes, right.
Yeah. One of those weeds that you just maybe want to try to make friends with?
if you can tolerate it, yes. Go ahead and make friends with it, but keep it at a distance. Don't let it get any closer.
Well, Ron Smith, you are our growing season expert. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
If anybody has a question for Ron, you can send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or toughtruck1@gmail.com, and that's TUFTRUCK, the number 1@gmail.com. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Preliminary numbers show oil production in North Dakota has reached the million barrel a day mark. State Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms.
March was 977,000 barrels a day, and the preliminary April looks like we're going to sneak across that finish line and get there.
Helm says the official April numbers will be released in June, and the industry is already preparing to celebrate the million-barrel mark. Ron Ness is president of the North Dakota Petroleum Council. He says it's a big deal.
We're going to point out how few places in the world, how few fields in the world have reached a million barrels a day. It really sets apart your oil field from other places in the world.
North Dakota is second to only to Texas in terms of U.S. oil production. Moorhead Representative Ben Lean says the recently wrapped up legislative session was very productive. Lean says all money was paid back to schools and funding for schools was increased by more than $3 million. Funding was also increased for nursing homes and property taxes were lowered for homeowners in Moorhead. Lean says the bonding bill was a great step forward as it included flood mitigation plans for Morehead, $20 million in broadband infrastructure, and more investments in job creation programs. Now, Lean says focus turns toward the fall election, but beyond that, there is work ahead for the legislature in 2015.
There are a lot of folks who would have liked to have seen the legislature do more with transportation this year. Of course, we were able to do some things, the corridors of commerce, and actually Representative Frank Kornstein from Minneapolis had a pretty big bill to look at rail infrastructure and pipeline safety with rail trains, and of course, Morehead being a big player in that issue. You know, I contacted him early on this legislative session and brought the concept of rail infrastructure. And so we were able to get crossing arms and things like that at a lot of the unregulated rail crossings around the state. But I think transportation will be the big issue in 2015.
Lean says another challenge facing Minnesota is how North Dakota's oil economy affects the state. He says he and Representative Kent Eakin sponsored a bill to address the opportunities and effects of the oil boom on Minnesota. Says there is still more work to be done on that in the next session. And former State Representative Maury Lanning of Morehead is pleased but not surprised that Minneapolis landed the 2018 Super Bowl. As chief house author of the Vikings Stadium bill 2 years ago, Lanning was a key player getting the legislation passed, assuring the new stadium would be a major selling point for winning the Super Bowl bid.
All along, we were led to believe that having a new stadium would give us sort of an inside track on being able to recruit the Super Bowl. It was never a sure thing, but Commissioner Goodell basically told us that that might lead to a Super Bowl success bid. And so it's great that that's come to be.
Lanning, who retired after the 2012 legislative session, said at the time that his reputation as a diplomatic leader was never more tested as he led the campaign to get the stadium bill okayed. He was threatened by emails and phone calls, criticized on blogs, and snubbed by members of both parties. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
And we're back on Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on vacation. And right now we are in the Memorial Union at NDSU. And we are here for the first ever Bioindustry Summit. And this is put on by the Red River Valley Research Corridor, which is acting basically as the overarching structure of researchers to bring together leaders in the biotech field, from heads of multinational companies to students learning the trade. Joining me now is Ryan Oshheim. He is an associate with the Red River Valley Research Corridor. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What is the role of the Red River Valley Research Corridor?
We are a nonprofit organization that really serves as a convening entity that brings together different entities around a certain topic or technology. Typically, it's technology-based. So probably one of the things that we do that we're most known for is these action summits like the Bioindustry Summit that you're at today. And these really serve as kind of a catalyst and a platform to energize a certain industry or technology subset. So, for example, we've done a number of action summits on different topics. We do a precision ag summit in January. In Jamestown, we're doing the unmanned aircraft systems in Grand Forks in June. That'll be our eighth one. And this bioindustry summit here was the inaugural event for this specific topic, technology around biotechnology and biomaterials and biofuels. And so obviously we hope to continue doing more of these. It seems like there's a demand and an interest and certainly an outlet for this topic.
A word like inaugural implies that this is a market on the grow. What's going on in this industry?
So as some of our speakers had talked in terms of some of the opportunities in areas for growth, you know, it ranges from, you know, your life sciences to vaccine technology development to biomaterials, biocomposites, developing plastics from bio. It can be natural resources. It can be, you know, it can be the byproduct of another refining process. I think probably what many people are familiar with is distiller dried grains, which are the byproduct of ethanol production that can be used to feed cattle. But you can use things like the wheat hull, the leftover components of wheat harvest to develop different bioplastics and biomaterials. So a lot of that research is going on here. There's companies that are being spun off using those licensed technologies to develop commercial applications. And so we'll actually be hearing from some of those firms later today when we talk about some of the specific commercial growth opportunities.
What is it about North Dakota that makes it a good place to study this?
Well, I think, the two big engines, UND and NDSU, are doing tremendous amount of research in a number of areas. This just happens to be, an area where they're doing a lot of research and development from, groups up at UND, EERC, and their chemical engineering programs that are doing, development of renewable fuels renewable fuels from algae-based sources along with a whole host of other research activities, polymers and coatings activities at NDSU, which are developing some of the biocomposite type materials and coatings from natural sources. So that's one aspect of it. I think, too, obviously agriculture is the backbone of the North Dakota economy. So obviously it stands to reason that that there's a whole lot of opportunity to develop value-added commercial applications for ag outside of some of the traditional ones that we've seen. So, extending that value chain even further so that that we can enhance and add value to those ag products that have been such an important part of the North Dakota economy for so long.
A backbone of the economy, and in particular the small farmer, has played an important role in that in North Dakota's history. And at an event like this, when you have a keynote speaker that's coming from Monsanto, where do you, as a research corridor, draw a line between working with global companies and small farmers and food producers and ranchers and scientists?
I think, the research corridor certainly encourages and supports the notion of bringing everyone to the table and hopefully serving as a platform or a forum where we're all different size groups from a large multinational global company to a small family farm can come and find some value at our events. Maybe they come and there's something that a Monsanto or another firm has to say that sparks an area of interest or provides some sort of idea and plants a seed, no pun intended, in the mind of an attendee who might be an entrepreneur or might be the operator of a family farm, and they might then develop a notion or a plan to target a specific market or develop a specific product or technology at their home. I mean, at the core of a lot of these research corridor events and activities is encouraging entrepreneurship and kind of empowering entrepreneurs and business owners and business leaders to take control of their own destiny. And so we hope that they can gain some insight from some of those bigger multinational firms or recognized brands, that they can talk about some of the trends nationally and globally out there. And, it might be something that not everyone always has access to or is aware of that kind of information. So we hope we bring some of that larger global influence in, which can help empower some of those local and regional interests.
Have you seen that happen outside of a one-day summit?
Yeah, we've, some of that becomes a bit anecdotal because, you'll hear stories later from firms or people that were at your event that they've developed a deal or a relationship with a firm, whether it's a major defense contractor in their small precision manufacturing firm. So we have certainly heard those stories where there's been relationships formed, and, I think it's debatable whether or not those relationships originated at one of our events, but we have some pretty strong testimonials that would suggest that.
What are some of the biggest hurdles facing the biotech industry?
Well, I think as we heard from Kathy Enright and Beth Calabata from the National or Bio Organization and Monsanto respectively, is certainly, you know, the regulatory environment can play a role in, I don't want to say obstructing, but certainly slowing down progress to some degree. I know that there are some biotech and life science firms that have to go through a very rigorous and lengthy process of FDA approval and clinical trials to get their technology or their product to market. Obviously, safety is important when you're talking about anything that's related to healthcare or our food chain. But I think some of those regulatory hurdles can be a bit onerous, and I think sometimes can certainly lead to challenges with companies that are trying to target a specific market where there's a lengthy trial or approval process that they have to go through.
One of those labeling processes comes with the term GMO, and that is certainly a term, genetically modified, that can make some people's backs bristle up a little bit. And silly things like men are confident and women are bossy. Is there some of that in just choice of the words when it comes to food labeling? And how do you counteract that?
Certainly with any technology that's disruptive or maybe not disruptive to our current way of life, there's going to be critics. And, you know, oftentimes we find it's easy to throw criticism out, and you spend a lot of time defending that criticism, whether it's founded or unfounded. As far as the GMO debate, I don't know that I'm qualified to specifically weigh in with my opinion on the merits or valid criticisms of GMO technology, but we find with unmanned aircraft systems industry, with GMO, with some life sciences and biotech, there are certainly criticisms, and you certainly don't have to be intimately familiar with the technology to cast out criticism, and you find that you spend a lot of time, I think, as Kathy Enright just mentioned, defending those criticisms and dispelling rumors or myths. And so that can be counterproductive. I think that goes back to your previous question about what are some of the challenges and hurdles, and certainly spending time fighting battles about misnomers or misconceptions about your technology or your industry, or, you know, detracting you from progressing with the development of your technology or the development of an industry. So I certainly think that there's some justified concerns and criticisms with any new technology, and there should be. People should be asking questions, and they certainly have a right to, and they should be saying, you know, we need to make sure that any technology that's developed is safe and legal and doesn't violate on anyone's rights. But I think it can become a bit easy for some critics to just throw out, you know, unfounded criticisms that it doesn't help anyone to have to spend time defending those.
So where do you go from here? What's next for the research corridor?
Well, in the short term, we're doing an unmanned aircraft systems action summit, which will be our eighth summit in June in Grand Forks at the Alaris Center. And so that's a two-day event with actually a third pre-day where we'll be doing demos to demonstrate some of the UAV aircraft in operation. And it's a two-day event that's really filled with a lot of different topical information about the unmanned aircraft systems industry, commercial applications, civil, you know, payload and sensor technology. So that's an event that's becoming more and more popular. It's becoming a nationally recognized event, and certainly with the designation of North Dakota as one of the six FAA UAS test sites, there's a lot more attention on North Dakota in general and the region. And in terms of the bio industry summit, this is our inaugural event, and you know, we certainly want to build upon this first year and continue doing an event that we think people will get some value out of, and certainly think that there's an interest in.
Ryan Oshheim is an associate with the Red River Valley Research Corridor. Ryan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we will meet a student who is studying in this field.
As part of an experiment, psychologist Linda Henkel sent students to a museum with cameras and a mission to remember what they saw.
The objects that they had taken photos of, they actually remembered fewer of them and remembered fewer details about those objects.
The relationship between photography and our memory, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered begins at 4 Central, 3 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
And we're back on Main Street, and I am joined now by Eric Krall, who is getting his master's degree at NDSU. Eric, what are you studying?
I'm studying coatings and polymeric materials.
What does that mean?
Basically, we work in a lot of the paint industries and work on new protective and coatings for different applications in the real world. It's an applied chemistry materials program.
How does a summit like this help you?
It's really interesting to be able to see from seed all the way up to the finished products where I'm working with, the line of where everything we get, where it's all coming from, how the farmers grow it, then how the processing occurs. And then once we get the chemicals from those products, how we can then use them to make useful products for everybody.
So walk me through that. What do you use and how do you use it?
Well, specifically my project works with lignin, which is a material that is derived from any plant material. It's in all plants. And we start... lignin that we are using comes from the paper pulping process. Right now it's a waste stream, and so we're working on breaking it up into useful chemicals that we can then use in the coatings industry to hopefully make some bio-based protective coatings for different applications.
So me, the consumer, what does that mean for me?
That means that as a consumer, you are hopefully in the end the cost will be competitive with petrochemicals, but also that the products that we are producing will be competitive for the long run because they are from renewable sources.
Is there a substantial difference in quality when it comes to petro-based versus plant-based, or is it merely in the availability of the source?
There is a big difference in the quality, and that's the challenge that we have to overcome because petrochemicals are very good. They work very well. They're very well researched, and they're cheap right now. And so to make something from a bio-based source, a lot of the challenges that need to be overcome are because we make in the bio-based products are have inferior properties. It's more economically viable to use petrochemicals because they work better and they are cheaper as of right now. But we're working on research to make our bio-based products cheaper and hopefully find niches where they can be more mechanically sound and provide a better product for a less price.
What kinds of inferiorities are you needing to correct?
Well, because the inherent diversity in plant-based products, there is not, it's very difficult to find, to get finite results from these. For example, getting lignin from an aspen tree versus a pine tree might be different, whereas when you're getting the same chemicals from crude oil, it's very consistent and reproducible, where we're having to overcome different challenges, like the diversity in species of plants.
Have you learned anything at this summit that you think could affect your research?
Yes, there's been a lot of research into GMOs that was just presented, and they have some very exciting results with the reproducibility and increased yields that they have been able to show, where they can produce more of their product in smaller plots of land using less energy in the long run, which would overall reduce the carbon footprint of producing the bio-based products.
I was talking with Ryan, one of the coordinators of the event. This is the inaugural event, but they'd like to maybe bring it back next year. What would you like to see done differently?
I think the event has been set up very well. I would like to see a little bit more of a poster session into the new research that's being done, not just here at NDSU, but all around the area, because it's going to take collaborative efforts between multiple different research sources, because collaboration of ideas and thoughts really is what's going to further the research.
Thanks so much for your time, Eric.
Thank you.
Cyberbullying is very common among teens, and it can be very hard to stop. The Stand Up ND Project wants to know what you do to protect your children online. Go to facebook.com/standupnd to share your story and join the conversation.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with Winnipeg author Sandra Sukan about her book, In Search of the Blue Lotus, talks about her growing up in Guyana and ending up in Canada, and we'll profile state Poetry Out Loud champion Julia Johnson from Shanley High School next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 21st. Reuben Humes was a young Dickinson sheep herder whose flocks were often threatened by predators like coyotes and bobcats. One day in 1900, Reuben went hunting for prairie chickens near the Heart River. His shotgun kept misfiring, but he finally shot a chicken, which dropped onto the opposite riverbank. As he forded the river to get it, he saw something. It looked like a big black sheep, he said. It was gray and had a huge mane of hair. I was so surprised I just stopped and looked. It was the largest wolf I had ever seen. Reuben fired, but his gun misfired, and the wolf took off. Back at camp, the men told Reuben he had seen a buffalo wolf, which is a subspecies of the gray wolf. Lewis and Clark discovered the buffalo wolf, Canis lupus nubilis, in 1804. Lewis wrote, "We scarcely see a gang of buffalo without observing a parcel of those faithful shepherds on their skirts in readiness to take care of the maimed and wounded. The large wolf never barks, but howls as those of the Atlantic states do." At first, the Corps of Discovery had lumped the wild canines into two groups. Coyotes were referred to as prairie wolves, and gray wolves were called large wolves. When they discovered the buffalo wolf subspecies, Lewis made detailed observations of how a pack would isolate an antelope from the herd so they could chase it down. He wrote, "They are very numerous. They are of a light color and has long hair with coarse fur." During the journey, brothers Reuben and Joseph Field caught a wolf pup, which they wanted to turn into a pet. They tied it up, but it quickly gnawed its way free and ran back into the wild. In the fall of 1843, artist John James Audubon painted both coyotes and wolves while near Fort Union. Referring to the coyote, he wrote,
The prairie wolf hunts in packs, but it is also often seen prowling singly over the plains in search of food. During one of our morning rambles near Fort Union, we happened to start one of these wolves suddenly. It made off at a very swift pace, and we fired at it without any effect, our guns being loaded with small shot at the time. After running about 100 yards, it suddenly stopped and shook itself violently, by which we perceived that it had been touched. In a few moments, it again started and soon disappeared beyond a high range of hills, galloping along like a hare or an antelope. Audubon also wrote about the white American wolf, or Canis lupus. The white wolf is far the most common variety of the wolf tribe to be met with around Fort Union, on the prairies, and on the plains bordering the Yellowstone River. When we first reached Fort Union, we found wolves in great abundance, of several colors, white, gray, and brindled. Audubon also wrote, "The common wolf is not unfrequently met with in company with the prairie wolf. On the afternoon of the 13th of July, as Mr. Bell and ourselves were returning to Fort Union, we counted 18 wolves in one gang, which had been satiating themselves on the carcass of a buffalo on the river's bank, and were returning to the hills to spend the night. Some of them had their stomachs distended with food, and they appeared rather lazy." In 1926, buffalo wolves were extinct, as were all wolf species within the state. Recent studies, however, indicate there may still be buffalo wolves in northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Upper Michigan. Wolves may also be recolonizing some of their former habitat right here in North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council. Do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via the Main Street at Prairie Public Facebook page. And you can still call. The Main Street toll-free studio line is 888-755-6377.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, News Director Dave Thompson. We are going to have a lengthy discussion about this week's headlines. Matt Olin reviews The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and The Lunchbox. Tom Ezern has his Plainsfolk essay he's calling Empty Stomach. We're also joined by Chef Rosendahl, and Bill Thomas and I take a look at what's happening in the week ahead. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, have a great evening.